Basically, I've got my own pace, but if you have any questions, whatever, feel free to interrupt me and ask questions because it's easier to answer questions as we go along. So I'd like to start with a historical note, right? Which is the fact that inflation didn't used to be a favorite theory of how of the source fluctuations in the early universe, and that it only became like the mainstream theory 10 years ago. Okay, so already, if you go back to the 90s, the source of primordial fluctuation was unknown. And at the time, there were essentially two options. One was inflation, which gave very, very generic predictions of the nearly scale invariant primordial power spectrum of adiabatic fluctuations, which essentially sit there. And the other thing was topological defects, which to some extent were very, very natural because they were predicted by essentially any theory that tried to unify everything. And so they were generically there because they arise when you have a phase transitions. But essentially, they were model dependent and they predicted a very, very different power spectrum. So essentially, to zeroth order topological defects continuously plow through the space time and generate new perturbations. And this, to zeroth order, they essentially produce white noise. Well, I wasn't science then. So inflation was partly invented also to get rid of the having too many defects, right?
Like
flatness other things, but okay, this was definitely times before it was science. But anyway, the bottom line is that this is to some extent irrelevant now because topological defects essentially predicted essentially white noise fluctuations. And even the late 90s, when the first power spectra came out, it was clear that something, this is the SIMB power spectra, something is happening at the scale of around L of 200, right? So there's some peak of bump, and inflation theory very, very generically predicted that there should be a series of acoustic peaks here that are there generically. And this strength of inflation, namely that you get essentially no matter what kind of potential you give it, now you just essentially draw something which is flat enough by hand, that you get this series of acoustic peaks, it's by the same time it's cursed, you know, because if you have generic predictions, it's very hard to differentiate between various models of inflation. So this is the same graph today. We all seen this WMAP 7 picture, and so it's really, really quite amazing how well this works. So if you try to constrain inflation, we need to use second order effects in the sense that we need to look at small departures from these extremely generic predictions of inflation. And as far as I can tell, you can actually there are essentially four different observational waves to constrain inflation. This is a picture of Linda and Guth at some sort of seafood dinner in the conference. So these four ways will be the first thing we need to measure departures from the power law spectrum, which essentially tell you that there is some structure in the in deflation potential.
You need deviation from the scale invariant spectrum of the power law is not a generic prediction. The scale invariant.
Yeah. Okay. So the generic prediction is close to scale invariant. Okay. So close to scale invariant. So. And any deviation from close to scale invariant will tell you something about inflation, right? So if you detect running, it will tell you something about inflation. And this essentially, okay, I agree. So yeah, but if you measure some more complicated departures, you will get you'll get more constraints on the shape of B. So the other thing is to measure the B modes of SIMB polarization, which essentially give you the energy scale of inflation. The third thing will give you to measure the so-called isocurvature modes in primordial fluctuations, which essentially tell you the more than one field working here. And finally, you could measure non-Gaussianity. Okay, and non-Gaussianity is what I will talk about in this talk. But it's quite amazing that that essentially, if you start thinking, there is not really much more than you can put on this list. At least I can't think of anything else. So to talk about non-Gaussianity, we have to start with discussing what Gaussianity is. And the main picture is that in the standard inflationary models, essentially the primordial coverage perturbation, and then in turn all the other observables are Gaussian. And Gaussianity is essentially defined by the fact that every Fourier mode has a random phase and amplitude which is randomly taken from a Gaussian distribution with variance p of k. Okay? And if this is the case, that if the modes are independent and their variance is simply p of k, then any odd point statistics vanish, and all even point statistics are completely determined by p of k. Right? So for Gaussian statistics, you tell me p of k, and this determines all possible statistical properties of field. Right? There's no statistical property of field which cannot be written as some sort of function of p of k. Now, the main point to realize about Gaussianity is that the Gaussianity can be falsified in the sense that once I find that this is not true, that the phases are correlated in some way, then I know that this is not the case. But non-Gaussianity cannot be, right? You cannot prove a Gaussianity simply because there are infinitely many ways, and infinitely many ways in which you can depart from Gaussianity. So if you look at so the way how it works is that in the minimal inflationary models, essentially the curvature perturbation is simply proportional to the perturbation in your field, and if phi is normally distributed, which it usually is, then so is curvature perturbation, and then everything else follows. And you can break non-Gaussianity in many different ways. Maybe if the scalar fields are not free, they are coupled, and so on. If you have non-linear corrections to the above equation, or if the initial state is not the Bunge-Davis vacuum, which everybody sort of puts in by hand. But in any case, the way how you break Gaussianity is extremely model dependent, right? So for every particular inflationary model, you can go and calculate what kind of non-Gaussianity you can do, but it turns out they are, as I said, very, very model dependent, precisely because there's so many different ways of breaking Gaussianity. So there's actually you have to start somewhere. And one generic way is to postulate that the curvature perturbation in the matrix domination obeys this equation, where phi is an auxiliary Gaussian field. So essentially, I take a Gaussian field, I add it back to itself with some parameter which I call FNL local, and then I get a non-Gaussian field. Okay? And this is actually motivated by some inflation theories, and it's by far not the only way of making non-Gaussian things, but it's easier for doing analytical calculations. So this is the so-called local non-Gaussianity, and it's local in real space. Okay, so this is real space operation, not Fourier space, and it's local in potential. Okay, so this is what you have to realize. It's local in real space in potential, but because it's local in potential, it means it's non-local in delta, right? In overdensity, because you get Laplacian here, essentially you get non-local. It's by far not the only possible non-Gaussianity, as I want to stress. There are many different ways, but there are two things to note, right? Basically, if we detect, maybe we detect just projection of some sort of more complicated Gaussianity into this one parameter thing, then we can check further. This is the first thing to note. And the other thing to note is we already know that FNL has to be quite small. Okay? So phi L is typically of the order 10 to the minus 5. And as I'll tell later, the typical limits on FNL are of the order 100. So we know that essentially universe is Gaussian to better than 0.1%, which I think is amazing, right? Which is also very encouraging because it also tells us that whatever departures from non-Gaussianity are small, so we can use very, very perturbative effects to do this properly. So I introduced this parameter FNL, which we'll try to constrain later. And what are the typical values for this parameter FNL? So the first thing to note is that the second order perturbation theory of GR will give you FNL of the order 1. Okay, and this is simply to say that the way we treat perturbations, we linearize the general relativity to first order, which then gives you phi in the differential equations. Of course, corrections to this to second order will be of the order phi squared. So you naturally expect that you will get corrections of the order phi squared. Of course, this depends on exactly how you measure, right? There's no one thing, but typically, second order perturbation theory in GR will give you FNL of 1, and you're guaranteed to measure this at some level, okay? This is bad because the simplest scalar field gives you of the order 10 to the minus 2. It's of the order of small parameters, epsilon and eta, and therefore this is completely it's very very swamped by this number. Okay, so the more complicated models give you FNL factor 10, okay, and between 1 and 10 is something which we hope to detect maybe 10 years, and would actually tell us something exciting about inflation. If you measure FNL bigger than 10, then this implies very very non-concordant physics, right? Something funny must have happened. The ideas like new periodic scenario, violence reheating. I don't even know how these things work. But FNL bigger than 10 would be extremely exciting in physics. FNL up to 10.
Yeah.
So if you have like curvature model, you can essentially cook up FNL anything you want, but on naturalized things you can get to the order 5, 7 easily, right? But if you have like very simple one field so on, then you get much better than one. Okay, my point is that 1 to 10 is not crazy. Bigger than 10 is crazy. Okay, then you get. But this is my understanding. But I'm not an inflation builder. So 1 is the limit.
It's more aspiration.
Well, because 10 it's 3 pi. Okay, so you could. No, you can imagine. You can imagine factors of 2s and pi's give you something which is bigger than 1. All right. Okay, maybe order 1. Okay. These are soft statements. They're not hard. Yeah, that's roughly my thinking. But there is no, as I said, there is no real limit. Okay. It's, so basically, how would you go and measure FNL? Okay, so in principle, what the first year physicists would do is essentially just take one point distribution function. Okay, so what you do, you get your pixel, say in CMB temperature, you draw a histogram, and if the histogram doesn't quite match the Gaussian, you measure along the center, right? This turned out actually to be a very, very bad way of doing it. And the main reason why it's very bad way of doing it is for statistical reasons. Because if you have a field, well, the best you can measure is one-point function, like simply the mean. Then you can measure the two-point function as a power spectrum, then the three-point function as a bispectrum, you can measure it a bit worse, and four-point function in worse. So as you go in orders in endpoint functions, your ability to measure them from finite number of measurements becomes worse. And one-point distribution function can be simply written as you can write this integral over all these moments, and therefore you mix things you can measure very well with things you cannot measure well at all. So it turns out it's much better to use higher-order correlators than using simply one-point distribution function. And because we know that the bispectrum should be zero in Gaussian theories, because it's a three-point function, if you measure something, you measure it on Gaussian, right? And as always, the CMB is the cleanest probe because it's linear and nice, right? And it turns out to be difficult to measure, because if you want to measure a three-point function, you have to go over all possible, triplets of points. But special estimators have been constructed by Komatsu and company and so on. So what are the current constraints on FNL from CMB? So you can see this is progression in time, roughly, okay? So from WMAP 3, you get numbers between -50 and 100, okay, quite sensible. Criminelli et al. Improved their estimator by using 1 point, got slightly better. Komatsu and WMAP 5. In the meantime, we actually got even one detection near Dow and Van Delt, which measured FNL bigger than 0.29 sigma, which used to be really exciting. Everybody suddenly started talking about FNL again, right? And here I have to, so Andre Albrecht at this time said, I don't go out of bed for less than 4 sigma. And he was actually paraphrasing Clint Evangelista, which was one of the best paid models, who said, I don't go out of bed for less than 10,000, right? But anyway, given this situation, I think they both can go out of bed for less than that. Sorry? Well, it's something to give you offer. I give you 10,000 or give you, 4 sigma detection deviation from W is -1. Which one do you take? Okay, anyway, so the reason that then this claim essentially went away when Kendry Smith wrote optimal estimators for these things. which essentially are more a computer science problem than physics. Probably you have to invert these huge matrices to do inverse covariance weighting. Eventually, he joined the WMAP team, and then this is the WMAP 7 results. So we're seeing this is two sigma results. We are quite nicely there in zero. You can do, this is you all. These all these methods are using bispectrum, but there are also other methods using wavelets and this how you call them? Minkowski functionals. Yeah, Minkowski functionals, and then you get sort of similar things, right? And while these things are actually sensitive also to other kinds of non-Gaussianities, so you have to calibrate them. Bispectrum is actually optimal for FNF, right? Which doesn't mean we shouldn't be using Minkowski functionals because they, if they detect something, might be interesting as well. Okay. So this is just a quick plot from Smith et al, right? So as you go to bigger and bigger L max to which you measure this, then you get these constraints of essentially saturates at some point. And with Smith et al, it was just on the border of 2 sigma. Now even this has gone. So it's for CMB, we don't see nothing exciting. So can you measure it for large-scale structure? Okay, large-scale structure would be much, much better simply because you have many more modes. Okay, CMB, it's a sphere. You have, you have 2L+1 integrated up to L max modes, so you have two-dimensional surface. But if you can measure the three-dimensional space, simply you have one more dimension, so the number of modes you have is much, much bigger, right? And if you measure in statistics, you're going to do it better. If you have the ability to probe the premodal density fields, then you could simply do it direct. You simply measure by spectrum, right? But it turns out that this is a very hard thing to do because in practice you never see the primordial density fields. You always see the evolved density fields, which has been processed through nonlinearities, which use their own non-Gaussianity. So these things are actually quite difficult to do from evolved fields. Okay. So there were some initial ideas when people wanted to do this, and the initial idea was actually to look at the mass function in the exponential tail. And the basic motivation here was say, well, I have objects of all kinds of masses, and objects essentially correspond to the rare peaks in the initial density field. So if my probability for having really, really rare peaks is increased, I'll have more rare objects, things like clusters of galaxies and so on. It turns out that this doesn't work very well simply because, it starts to work better and better and better as you go to rarer and rarer objects, but by construction you have fewer and fewer of them, right? So it turns out, and there are also observational issues, how we're going to match mass to initial peak height and so on. So this actually was very, didn't work out very well. So then I will make a quick detour before I talk about this new idea, which is very interesting how this all played out. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning and just see how galaxies evolve. Right. So suppose you form galaxies in the universe, and this process is extremely complicated. Right. It's full of astrophysics, different processes. Right. But what you can safely assume, you say, it's a local function. The local number density of galaxies, right? It must be a local function of primordial fields. Okay. So if you have some primordial Gaussian fields, and you say whether a galaxy will decide to form here can be stochastic function, but essentially it's local. It cannot pull information from over there, right? So galaxy will decide I'm going to form here based on what's happening in say 10 megaparsecs radius around it. But it's not going to care what's happening very, very far away. Okay? And I think this is extremely, extremely conservative assumption, right? Because you simply, gravity is the only thing, and it's very hard to make these actions at distance, right? It turns out that if you start with this very, very simple assumption, then if you go to very, very large scales, scales larger than which this locality operates, then the galaxies have to follow the matter density fluctuations. They have to be proportional to them using some factor, which you call the bias factor. And there must be, maybe there's some stochastic component, maybe just galaxies create, pop out at random. But this essentially follows simply from the fact that you assume that galaxy formation is local. in the primordial fields of Gaussian. So if this is the case, then you get that the galaxy power spectrum follows the matter power spectrum, and maybe this you get the white noise component, right? But essentially, the matter power spectrum is galaxy power spectrum is proportional to matter power spectrum on scales much larger than this locality, right? And this is extremely what I want to know. This is extremely robust. Okay, it's very hard to go around this. And this has actually been observed, right? So this is actually quite an old picture, but I think it's very illustrative. So if you split the galaxies into different colors, these are very bright galaxies, and these are not so bright galaxies. So this black line is the dark matter power spectrum, and galaxies essentially, you see, they follow observationally what dark matter is doing, right? The constant proportionality might be different, but the shape is the same. Okay. And we think we understand this why this works, right? And in a very toy model picture, you can think of galaxies forming in the rare peaks. Okay, so may imagine that this is your Gaussian field, this is your primordial field of fluctuations, you know, the Gaussian noise, and then you say, well, above some threshold, I'm going to say, well, this is a peak, I'm going to put a galaxy here, right? So galaxies corresponds to rare peaks in your primordial field. Okay. So now let's see what happens if I put some sort of long scale mode, right? Because every universe has long scale and short scale modes. And you see, if galaxies ride on top of a large scale mode, it's much easier for them to actually pop out over this band, right? So the bottom line is that if I go to the top of the large scale mode, I'll have plenty of galaxies. And if I go to the bottom, I'll have essentially none, okay? So this small fluctuation gets essentially amplified due to this exponential nature of how galaxies form, right? That's essentially why contrast in galaxies is always bigger than contrast in the underlying dark matter field, okay? And this essentially gives this constant biasing, saying that the big massive galaxies corresponds to rarest peaks, and they are even more exponentially sensitive to what large-scale modes are doing, and therefore you get a constant bias. So what was the big breakthrough in 2007 was that the Dalal essentially nearly serendipitously noticed that if you have non-Gaussian universes, this breaks down. Okay, so what he realized is that this bias, which you tend to constant as you go to larger and larger scales, so this bias becomes scale dependent. Okay, so the clustering of rare peaks in FNL cosmologies, which corresponds to clustering of galaxies, acquires this scale dependent bias. So bias, it's not constant, but it's dependent of k. And this is the thing is to actually see things. Okay, so this is the power spectrum of dark matter fluctuations. And if I look at the halos, okay, which you can think of corresponding to galaxies, if I go to cosmologies, we have non-zero FNL plus 100 or minus 100, then essentially the galaxies stop following the dark matter on very large scales. Okay, and this is actually extremely nice and robust, because you know roughly what the shape of dark matter spectrum is from the CMB, and then you can measure with galaxies. And if the galaxies don't follow this shape, then you can either say, well, the galaxy formation process is extremely non-local, or there is some non-Gaussianity going on, right? So despite the fact that we don't understand the galaxy formation, you can still use galaxies to actually measure FNL. Okay? And the reason why it's easy to understand this is the following: if you have FNL cosmologies, you have non-Gaussian universe, right? And non-Gaussian universe means you have non-zero bias spectrum. And in practice, it can be shown that this, in FNL cosmologies, in particular, you get coupling between large scales and small scales. Okay, and this works in the way that if I'm riding on top of a large scale mode, okay, my local sigma 8, my local amplitude of fluctuation increases, and if I'm riding on the bottom of the long large scale mode, it actually decreases. So suddenly, if I'm riding on the top of the large scale mode, not only it's easier for me to get over this barrier because I'm higher already, but also the local fluctuations actually increase, right? The local power increases, so it's even easier, right? And this is what essentially gives rise to this scale dependent effect. So this is the equation which has been first derived in the Dalal et al., which gives you the size of this change in bias. You see, it's proportional to the b minus 1, so non-biased objects, as in dark matter, don't receive anything. It's proportional to FNL, so if FNL is 0, you don't get anything. But it's also, it has this wonderful k squared dependence, which is amazing. So as you go to larger and larger scales, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, right? So exactly in the regime when it should be becoming more and more constant, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. So this has been now, this result has been scrutinized to death, essentially. There are a bunch of derivations. Shorty provided one of his own. We have McDonald, Matres and Verde, Gentonino, Pichani. Essentially, there are very different ways to see how this comes about. So the way we did it, the way we did it in our paper, and we'll actually go through a little bit of how other people did in different papers, is essentially simply to realize that, you know, very hand-wavingly, if, as I said before, if I large on top, if I write on top of large scale mode, essentially my fluctuations will get bigger. And therefore, you can actually show that this bias correction simply corresponds to the way how your number density of objects responds to the change in the normalization of power spectrum in Gaussian universes. Okay, so in a way it's very simple because you simply all you do is you take you know how your local number of objects varies as a function of sigma 8 in Gaussian cosmologies, and therefore you can predict how big this effect will be. The strength of this approach is that actually it allows you to predict this for any kind of objects, right? You just give me objects, you tell me how it behaves in Gaussian cosmologies, so I can predict what the scale-dependent bias will be. And in particular, we show that this formula derived by Dallard et al., it's exactly the same in all theories in which a mass function is simply a function of this. For those of you who know, this is a projector formalism, just essentially saying it's for universal mass functions, which we think majority of objects are universal like this, the original equation works. So there was another derivation by Verde and Matarese, in which essentially what they've done it's in a way different. So they look at what the statistics of peaks of Gaussian fields. Okay, and it turns out that if you have weakly non-Gaussian if you have weakly non-Gaussian peaks, the two-point function of peaks, okay, of a weakly non-Gaussian field, can be written as a sum over a two-point function, three-point function, four-point function, and so on. Okay, so if I give you a formula for three-point function, then I can simply plug it into this formalism, and it will essentially give me what the clustering statistics of peaks of these fields are, right? And because we think peaks corresponds to objects in the universe, this essentially allows you to calculate what the effect will be for any non-Gaussian, okay? And when they plug the bias spectrum of the local non-Gaussian, essentially they recover the Dallard's formula, modulus and corrections, but they essentially get it. But the beauty of that approach is that you can essentially plug in any non-Gaussian you want. You can plug in the so-called equilateral non-Gaussian, which is different non-Gaussian, and fold it, and you see whether there are any effects. And actually, I've done this in this paper, which came out like half year ago. And again, this is the k-dependence, okay? This is essentially the size of this effect. You can think of it as beta being the size of the scale-dependent bias. And they show that if you have the local non-Gaussian, you get this 1/k² dependence, the way I talked about before. But if you have equilateral and folded non-Gaussian, you get effect which is by a factor of 10^4 smaller. Okay, 10^4, even 10^6 smaller. Okay, and this is precisely for the reasons I've told you before. In equilateral and folded kind of bispectra, there is no coupling between large scale and small scale modes, so this effect essentially goes away. Yes. Yeah, so what do you mean? So I'm saying that if you have equilateral and folded, so basically I need for this effect to work, I need to have two large scales and one small scale, right? And the two low k's, which are two large scales, and one high k, which is the small scales, right? And the small scale essentially is the size that controls the formation of halos. Okay, is this right?
It's the size of the halo.
Yeah. So in this approach, essentially you integrate this complicated formula, okay? And it turns out that you can integrate it for any 3-point function I give you, right? No. Okay. I see. So FNL Lagrangian can be converted. This local Lagrangianity phi equals phi goes to phi plus FNL phi squared can be converted to effective by spectrum, right? And if I plug in this by spectrum, I recover the last formula. But now I'm able to plug in different by spectrum, right? And it just happens that if you plug different by spectra, you don't get anything, right? But I'm saying this, you should expect this, because for these things to work, you need to couple between large scale and small scale modes, and it simply doesn't happen in other phenomena scientists, right? Okay. The other thing they did, which I thought is sort of sweet, I'm not sure whether it's right, is of course what you can do. You can calculate what by spectrum you expect from second order perturbation theory, okay? And you can still plug it in, right? And they say that the second order perturbation theory gives something. Well, so this is essentially showing that this line overlaps with this one. The second order perturbation theory gives something which corresponds to FNL of 1.6, okay? So according to them, if their calculation is right, we are guaranteed to measure FNL of 1.6 using the scale-dependent bias, and this FNL will be sourced by second-order perturbation theory, even if the primordial non-Gaussian is zero. Okay. So of course this has been tested extensively in simulations. The first simulations were done by Dallal et al., which I've shown before. But their simulation was actually quite small. They were like less than gigaparsec. But the bottom line, it seems to work like magic, right? A lot of people have done simulations later on. There seems to be even some disagreement between Lichaverde the simulation and some other people. I'm just showing results from Dejac here. I'm not going to go into detail why disagreement is. But I think the bottom line is that actually the effect I've shown works extremely well. And so particularly this simulation with the Jacques, it's quite beautiful because they see two other secondary effects. So the one secondary effect is simply when you go to non-Gaussian cosmologies, not only you get the scale dependent bias, but you also get a small change in the scale independent bias, right? Simply because your rare peaks change, and they see this. And the other thing is your second order corrections in the weakly nonlinear spectrum change a little bit. This is the so-called Tarrouille effect, which calculated this thing. And these two effects are actually quite small. They're like 1% effects. And they see both of them. So I think that their simulations are kosher. But as far as this main equation goes, it seems to work without any further corrections. It's really amazing how well this analytical formula works. There is also another approach, which was done by Gentonina and Porciani, which is the third one. You would just say, OK, so let the overdensity in halos be a function. Let's expand it both in delta, which is the usual approach, but let's also expand it in phi, okay? And phi is the potential. So I write this more general biasing prescription, and then I plug it into a bunch of equations, and then it turns out essentially that as I go from small scale to large scales, the B10 goes to zero and B01 increases, or make B01 become plus one. So essentially on large scales, phi follows. So on large scales, your data halo starts following phi and delta, okay? And that's essentially the reason why you get this 1/k² change in bias, simply because phi is delta divided by k². So if I follow phi, then sooner or later this thing will take off. Okay? So this is from a theoretical perspective, and how would you go about measuring it? So if you go back to this equation which describes how big this effect is, we see there are two things to know. Okay, so first thing, it's proportional to b⁻¹. So you want to go to objects which are highly biased, okay? Objects which have high b. Which typically corresponds to very, very massive objects, rare and massive objects, like QSO, cluster of galaxies, and so on. You also see that this effect also is 1/k², so you want to go to extremely large volumes to do it properly. And also it has this D of Z thing in the numerator, which is essentially growth factor, so you want to go to high redshift because it becomes bigger at high redshift. And I think Niyesh was the first to note that this factor is missing here. So essentially, you need large volume surveys of highly biased structures. So when we did this 2 years ago, we use LRGs, QSO, and ISW. This is just one graph showing how this effect shows on corresponding to real data. These are photometric LRGs from SSS. These are photometric quasars from SSS. And this is the so-called ISW effect. And the easiest thing to see is these spectroscopic LRGs. So these are actual measurements from TEGMAC et al. The red points are measurements. The black line is the Gaussian model. And then you see maybe just about the red line and the blue lines are the non-Gaussian models with FNL of plus 100 to minus 100. And you see they start deviating at the larger scales accessible to SDSS LRGs. Okay? So we are barely able to see this using the present simulations. But it's clearly that the points prefer to stay there, all right? So these are the results if you use various combinations of data, the results tighten, tighten, tighten. I don't have time to go through all these numbers. But the final limits we get, depending exactly how you treat quasars, are roughly FNL is between minus 30 and 70, okay? And if you look at the numbers I've shown you before from CMP, it's quite amazing that even with the present generation of the data, you can actually you are completely competitive with CMP. Okay, and if you combine this with CMP measurements, you get something like minus 1 to 63. Okay, this was before WMAP 7. So we're not quite in the interesting regime of reaching FNL for around 10, but we're approaching. You know, maybe in 5-10 years this will be better. There also one thing I would like to stress is that all these things are not quite optimized. For example, the TEGMAC LRGs, we just use whatever he suggested. But you can do things better by selecting. You know, I'm going to take fewer galaxies which are brighter, have higher bias, and have more sensitivity. Right. So you can build special estimators that can do these things better. This is planned to do essentially eventually. So. This entire method has been later generalized to bispectrum of a tracer. So what Yanko and Komatsu did in 2009 is say, okay, if I get this unexpected effect that FNL affects my power spectrum, which it doesn't for the dark matter, but it does for biased objects, what happens in if I look at bispectrum fields? Okay. So what they found is essentially that the same thing happens in bispectrum. So in addition to the normal term, which is proportional to the FNL in bispectrum, you get this equivalent term, which is equivalent to this scale-dependent bias in power spectrum, which scales as FNL squared. Okay. So interesting is if you say if FNL is not negligibly small, then this thing should be much, much easier to detect in bispectrum than people previously thought. Okay. So this is definitely something you should look at. It also turns out that basically one important thing from this paper is the different effects are different triangle dependence. So if you can measure by spectrum for big enough range of triangles, you can essentially distinguish between non-Gaussianity, second order perturbation theory, and other effects. Okay, and also. You have very, very, very different redshift effects, right? So as you go to higher redshift, the non-Gaussianity goes up, right? But non-linearity goes down, okay? So if you see something, you can simply go and see it again at higher redshift and see if everything is consistent. So there are a couple of things we need to clear up. The first thing is that, so I've told you, right? If B goes as 1/k², right, and P of K goes as 1/k⁻⁴ on very large scales, right? And then it turns out that the correlation function diverges, right? Because correlation function is Fourier transformed over the power spectrum. So if your power spectrum goes as k⁻⁴ on very, very large scales, then for any R, the correlation function written like this formally diverges, right? And people were really, I was really worried about this. Because it's something wrong.
But it turns out that actually, if you look at the measured correlation function, it is always okay. Okay. If you, and the reason why the measured correlation function is always okay is because what you do when you measure correlation functions, you do a survey of galaxies, you count them, and then the number of galaxies divided by your volume gives you the mean number density, and this is around the range which you expect, right? And of course, if you have some extremely large perturbations on top of them, which you don't see, then you're simply not going to see it because you always, you always enforce your correlation function to go to zero, right?
I'm worried about that at some point too. And that seems like it can be part of the answer, but I'm not sure it can be the whole answer because the correlation function, is that if I recall right, it goes negative at large separations. That just doesn't make sense. I mean, that would imply arbitrarily negative densities.
No. Correlation function has to go negative because it has to satisfy integral constraints. So correlation function essentially integrates to zero, right?
Sorry, is this correlation function of what?
Of Halo, say, right?
Halo
density, yeah.
So you're worried about infrared divergence, yeah?
Yes.
So why are we thinking about Halo?
So we
go to the universe?
No, okay. So the fact is that we have this FNL, not
FNL. The Eternian
potential is one of the K. I could one of the K is 4 because this is for scale depends on bias, right? So they disclaim in FNL, they disclaim by the Dallal et al. that if I go and look at the objects, like halos rather than density fields. They acquire the scale-dependent bias in non-Gaussian cosmologies. So bias goes as one over k squared in the limit of very small k of halos rather than matter. Okay, and this has been shown to be extremely, extremely robust, right? It has been really right to many, many different ways. So even though people were skeptical, I think it's clear that this fact is true. Okay, so if we forget about horizon issues and so on, the fact is that if I say this P of K is P dark matter times B squared, and it's B goes as 1 over K squared, I get 1 over K to the 4, okay? And this 1 over K squared comes from Poisson equation, that's true, right? But the B, it comes in twice, so we get K to the 4, and this is the form of divergence, right? Okay? And some people always claim, well, there will be some sort of GR effects on top of horizon which can solve this. But it turns out it's actually perfectly fine. And we did this in paper with what's his name? Wants. David Wants, yes. And it's not a very sophisticated calculation. You just say, assume I have a small patch of sky, and I just define my mean density to the mean density of the patch of sky, and just plug it through, and everything becomes fine. Essentially, simply take off fluctuations, which are due to your window function. So there are other issues, other infrared divergences, and this is the fact that am I getting any other GR corrections on very, very large scales? And the reason for this is that basically it's not even clear what is observed on scales much larger than the horizon, okay? Because what we usually, if you get an output from CAMP or simply fast, you get a power spectrum which goes through all k's, but this is a gauge dependent power spectrum, right? Synchronous and Newtonian power spectrum are very different on very large scales. So small scales, this is all the same, but what happens if you go to really, really large scales? So again, in this paper, we somewhat trivially shown that if you think of spherical collapse, and you essentially try to see which gauge is spherical collapse is actually done, there are no effects, right? But to do this program properly, you really need to do what has been done for CMB in 90s, essentially just to see what are the observables. I'm measuring positions and redshifts. And this is actually, to be quite honest, has never been done for galaxies. A new et al. Has been working on it, but it hasn't been finished yet. So there is another paper in preparation with Hirata and Seljaković, in which this is just a very short brief advertisement, in which we generalize this to two field models. If you have an inflaton and curveton, and just put this FNL in curveton, and lo and behold, you get a very, very similar effect coming out. I don't have time to go through it. But essentially, you can generalize this to more complicated models as well. Let me see what I'm going to talk about. I've got 10 more minutes, okay? So there are a couple of other developments with respect to FNL, which I think are very nice. So one thing is that we think we can avoid sample variance, right? So the above method, which I talked so far, relied on the scale dependence of bias, which you detect through a power spectrum, okay? So the problem with doing this way is if you go to larger and larger scales, the effect becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, but you have fewer and fewer modes to measure this effect, right? So if you go to very large scales, you're limited essentially by your sample variance, okay? So Seljak proposed a way around it, okay? And the way around it essentially is to use two tracers of the same underlying mode, okay? And then simply, if I take the ratio of these two of the measured modes, I can measure this effect. And the reason is the following, right? Suppose we have an underlying fluctuation in dark matter, which is this black line, okay? If I try to measure the power spectrum using exactly one mode, I would essentially be limited. I wouldn't be able to measure power spectrum using one mode. Well, I could measure it, but with extremely large noise, okay? Now, suppose I have two tracers, say galaxies and quasars, which trace the same volume, okay? If this mode is large enough, they will have one extra bias in galaxies and another extra bias in quasars, okay? And then what I can do, if I take the ratio of the number density of these two things in k-space, I'll essentially measure the relative biases, which is all I need to actually measure FNL, right? So I don't need to care about what's happening with underlying dark matter. I can simply measure two tracers over the same volume, take the ratio of their power spectra, and the sample variance cancels out, right? And suddenly you can do it much, much better. It turns out that you can only do it much better if you have good enough sampling of these modes, if you're not Poisson limited, okay? And this is not where most of the experiments are, but we hope to be here in the future. But there's also, so this is one thing which I think is very promising for the future, but there's also another thing which I'm working on. I think it's very exciting. So this is the so-called Lyman alpha forest. And this is a very observational thing in which you say, if I have a quasar very, very far away, it will absorb light if I have a quasar, it will have some sort of Lyman alpha emission line, okay? And its light, it will propagate towards us and redshift at the same time, okay? So what happens, every time this light goes through the so-called cloud of neutral hydrogen, it gets absorbed, okay? So if I look at the spectrum of real quasars, blueward of the Lyman alpha emission line, I get this so-called forest, which corresponds dips, which corresponds to the absorption by clouds of neutral hydrogen. Okay, and this is an example of this Lyman alpha forest. So if I go to these 3.6 quasars here, if I go bluewards of Lyman alpha forest, and this is Lyman beta, I get all this forest, and this forest actually corresponds to fluctuation of the neutral hydrogen density along the line of sight. Okay. Sounds crazy, but the bottom line is that fluctuation in neutral hydrogen density essentially trace fluctuations in the dark matter. Okay, fluctuation in neutral hydrogen density trace the fluctuations in the baryons, which in turn trace fluctuation in dark matter. So you can use this technique to essentially to measure the structure of the universe. It has a lot of advantages over galaxies in the sense that it goes through the typical parts of the universe rather than be limited to few selected peaks. And this is part of program of the BOSS experiment, which tries to measure BAO redshift of 3 using this technique. And there are analytical models that tell you how the mapping between this absorption and the underlying dark matter goes. Okay? It turns out that if you assume photonization equilibrium, you get this very simple mapping, which tells you that optical depth at a certain redshift, it simply corresponds to the dark matter of a density to some factor of beta, which is typically 1.8. And then the flux just e to the minus tau. So again, it's very similar to what happened with galaxies. The galaxies have got some very nonlinear mapping between dark matter and the number length of galaxies. And as a result of this nonlinear mapping, I get a scale-dependent bias in galaxies, which allow me to measure FNL. Here, I get some very nonlinear mapping between density and flux, which I measure. And as a result, you get exactly the same equivalent Dallal effect that you get with galaxies. So this beta is around it's around is okay. So the beta is around 1.8, okay? And the reason to think of 1.8 is roughly 2, okay? And the fact is that you if I'm in over density, okay, the number of recombinations of protons and electrons into hydrogen is going to go as n squared, okay? And this is exactly balanced by the photon path of quasar photons that are around, okay? That's why in a trivial picture you simply expect the density of neutral hydrogen to go as the 1 plus delta squared, okay? Yeah, okay. It's slightly less than squared because you have temperature dependence of these coupling factors, okay? But it turns out that this sounds like a crazy prescription, but it on scale is bigger than 100 kiloparsecs. It seems to work fairly well, at least at the level of two-phase action. Okay. So it turns out that basically, so this I have these are very simple Gaussian simulations now using this prescription, and for power spectrum which shows no change, I don't detect anything. But the Lyman alpha power spectrum actually, you get exactly the same effect as you get with the Lyman. You get extra power on very, very large scales, okay? And I think we're still writing this paper. It has been checked in n-body simulations that in fact you do get the same effect is present in Lyman alpha force power spectrum. So we're still thinking whether how observable this is, but it's not clear that it's not observable, okay? No, the reason is the laminar forest. The reason is it's very trivial. You only see laminar forest at high redshift. If nothing else, because you go to low redshift, your laminar forest goes into UV, in which case it's unobservable because of transparency issues. And basically, you simply don't have enough high density of anything else at these high redshifts. I mean, people talk about various things in head decks, try to take lots of logic, but it's going to be very, very hard. Okay. The trick you can play with laminar force is you have so many points you can actually take the field itself, square it, okay, and then essentially you create a slightly different tracer. And this looks like some sort of strange game to play, but this is not an idea we work on. Or simply makes you what you can do, you can make some sort of again nonlinear transformation to flux into something in which this effect is maximized, okay. But these are more complicated ideas. But the fact that we are now trying to measure this Lyman alpha spectrum and it looks quite encouraging. Like what people worry there will be large scale effects due to photonization fluctuations, so and so things like that. At the moment, they do not seem to be there, at least not in very, very large numbers. Well, it turns out nobody really knows that claims. Exactly, nobody really knows, but the best thing to do this is to measure this, right? And we will measure this with BOSS. But the bottom line is that in any case, this effect becomes bigger and bigger than scale, right? Well, if you look at the radiation field, well, it can probably fluctuate on typical distance between quasars, right? So if you go to distance on scales much larger than typical interquasar distance, it's going to become homogeneous, right? Everything has to become homogeneous.
No, the largest scale fluctuations and everything are the same. That is exactly the thing, if you're interested in, that's fluctuating on a large scale, right?
So yeah, but they're going to drop essentially exactly. The fluctuations in the photonization field are going to follow delta, not phi, right? Non-gaussian is the only thing that makes you follow phi.
But the photon travel along the can fluctuate on large. I mean,
ideally, a very large space. Well, maybe you're right, because simply the quasars will also be following phi, right, in non-gas universes. So maybe.
Well, I mean, that's something to worry about, okay.
Anyway, so this is not cooked. It's just something I'm getting excited about. I'll essentially finish here. You can read conclusions here, but I think the basically to sum up, I think non-Gaussian entity, I think we'll be able to push it down to FNL less than a few in 5 years with BOSS, and maybe then later Big BOSS and LSST, 5 to 10 years, and I think then it will have started becoming really, really interesting for constraining inflation. Okay, thank you. So what Matarese and Verde claim is, well, what you measure is FNL, intrinsic plus 1.6, okay? So I guess if you measure 1.3, then you can claim, okay, it's minus 0.3 plus 1.6, okay? But the fact is that if it's 10 to the minus 2, how can you tell the difference between 1.6 and 1.6 plus 10 to the minus 2, right? Then If you measure something away from zero, then you're always making the differential measurement, right? If you try to measure something on top of 1.6, which is much less than one, then it's going to become essentially very, very difficult. Then I guess then the only way would definitely be go using bispectrum, because then at least they have different shape dependence, right? But using these power spectrum methods, you're essentially limited by the fact that. Yeah, formally speaking, you can, but observationally, this is not how it works, right? Because if you measure, I only need to understand if I go to think when this thing is 10% effect. Well, I think it's going to be very difficult.
There are no more questions. Let's thank Andrew.